Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here is Bob.
That people that show John Wayne, you see it? It was on TV a while back. Remember when the Mexican army played this certain tune, and everybody said, "What is that?" And it was a tune that meant death to everyone in the Alamo. Remember that? I forgot the name of it. It was a Spanish name for it. But it meant death to everyone in war. Well, the harem is the Jewish equivalent to that Mexican song in the Alamo. It meant death to everyone. Women, children, babies, old people, everybody was killed. Cattle, sheep, you know, you name it, it was killed. Chickens. And so that's a very hard thing for us to talk about, and that's going to be one of the things we cover here. So I think the easiest thing for me to do is to read it in sections. And again, remember that the Bible is just like an English class, in a sense. If you'll read the Bible a paragraph at a time, and if you'll try to find the central idea of that paragraph, you'll have in a nutshell what God's trying to say to us. So let's read verses 1 through 11, which is the first paragraph in my translation. Then we turned and went up the road to Bashan, and Og, the king of Bashan, and all his people came out to meet us in battle. But the Lord said to me, "Do not fear him, for I have delivered him and all his people in his land into your hand. And you shall do to him just as you did to Sihon, king of the Amorites, who lived in Heshbon." So the Lord our God, delivered Og also, the king of Bashan, with all his people into our hand, and we smote them until there was no survivor left. And we captured all his cities, and at that time there was not a city which we did not take from them, 60 cities, all in the region of the Argob, the kingdom of Og in Bashan. And these are the cities fortified with high walls, gates, and bars, besides a great many unwalled towns. And we utterly destroyed them, as we did Sihon, king of Heshbon, utterly destroying the men, women, and children of every city. But all the animals and the spoil of the cities we took as our booty. But we took the land at that time from the hand of the two kings of the Amorites, who were beyond the Jordan, from the valley of Arnon to Mount Hermon. The Canaanites, and they have them here, Sidians, call Hermon, and I can't pronounce these Aramaic names, I'm sorry. I guess it's Sirion, and the Amorites call it Sener, or something like that. All the cities of the tableland, and all Gilead, and all Bashan, as far as Selek and Eridi, cities of the kingdom of Og of Bashan, and only Og, king of Bashan, was left of the remnants of the Rephaim. Behold, his bedstead was of iron, a bedstead. It is in Rabbah, and the sons of Ammon. Its length is 9 cubits, and its width is 4 cubits, by an ordinary cubit. You see, we're not the first to have a king-size bed. They had it in the Old Testament. Now, let's go back through this thing, and let's kind of see where we are. These two kingdoms, the kingdom of Sihon and the kingdom of Og, are mentioned several times in the Bible together. They're mentioned in Psalms 135:11 and Psalms 136:19 and 20 together. And so this was a thing that Israelites over and over again went back to, like the Exodus, to remind them of what God had done in the past. And because God had acted in the past in such a way, we can trust God in the future, was the Hebrew way of thinking. And so over and over they would tell these stories of these two kings. Now, your translation, if you have a New American Standard like I do, and many of you have that, on the first verse, your sentence ends with the word battle, meet us in battle. But every other Hebrew manuscript I can find, and every other translation of the Bible that I can get my hands on, adds the little phrase at Eridi, E-D-R-E-I. Now, this is in the best manuscripts, and you ought to add it to your Bible. It's the name of a city, and it's mentioned down here a little later, so you can know how to spell it. And it is one of the royal cities of the king of Bashan. And we find that from Deuteronomy chapter 1, verse 4, where it says, list this city as one of the king's places. Ashtaroth was one, and Eridi is the other. And so here we have both of them mentioned. Now, it's located on one of the forks of a river called the Yarmuk, Y-A-R-M-U-K. And the reason it's so significant is this is the border between these two countries, and this capital was right on the border, and so they're crossing into a new country now. You see where it says, we turned up the road? Now, what road is that? There's two roads that we've talked about, and I want you to get a picture. You picture my body as the Sinai Peninsula, okay? Here's the Red Sea, and here's the Sea of Aqaba. Okay. It'd be backwards for you. This is the Red Sea, this is the Sea of Aqaba, okay? Now, there's a road that starts way down here on the Sea of Aqaba and goes right up through Moab, Ammon, right up through Bashan. It's called the King's Highway. There is another road that runs this way called the Arabah Road. It's called the Way of the Red Sea in Deuteronomy. And it goes a little bit over this way up by Kadesh Barnea. So the road it's talking about here is the King's Highway. It goes right through the middle of all these countries in the Transjordan, a major caravan route. Now, Bashan, the derivation of this term is very hard. Epistemologically, it either means rough ground, fertile ground, rough place, something like that. But it's a very fertile land, very fertile. Large herds of cattle, very famous for its forests. So it's a very rich land. Matter of fact, in the book of Amos, I think chapter 4, it says, it calls the ladies the fat cows of Bashan, which is a wonderful term for ladies, and talking about its wealth, you know, and all. So, no more comment on that. Now, if you look in verse 2, where it says, just as you did to Sihon, king of Amorites, who lived at Heshbon, here again this overriding Hebrew theology. As God has acted in the past, you can trust him in the present. You see, Hebrews are very practical people. They don't want you to ask, tell me how a machine works. Show me a blueprint. Tell me how you designed it. Tell me about all the physics that go into it. They say, if you turn the thing on, does it work? Does it do what it's supposed to do? Well, if it does what it's supposed to do, they're happy. That's all they want. So God is a God that does what he's supposed to do. God is not a God like the idols they pray to and cut themselves and holler and scream and doesn't answer, but God is a God that acts in history. And because God acts in history, we can trust him in the present, you see. Now, notice if you would when it says, and the Lord God delivered up Og, verse 3. Now, men went out to fight. These tribes fought. We find it from many, many places in the book of Numbers 32. This is parallel. They went out with sword in arm and they beat the kingdom of Bashan with their swords. But Hebrew theology says it was not the skill of your warriors, nor the amount of your troops, nor the intelligence of your commanders. The Lord God is the one who's given you the battle. So you see, the Hebrew psychology is that God is involved in everything. This is called a holy war. God told them to take this country. Now, because God told them to take this country, and the concept of holy war is a concept we find in many parts of the Old Testament, this little thing about there was no survivor left. And then down in verse 6, you find the words twice used, utterly destroyed. Now, the Hebrew of the words utterly destroyed in an English translation is the Hebrew has under the ban. The word for ban is the word harim. It may be related to the word for Mount Hermon. It definitely is related to the city in the south called Hormah. Now notice that the limits of the promised land are boxed in by two geographical locations that are related to this theological concept of destroy everyone in a holy war. Possibly Mount Hermon, definitely Hormah. So it looks like that God has almost showed them how far to go by the use of this word. Now, when it says no survivors, I want you to please turn the back of your sheet somewhere or down here. I want to give you a definitive list of Old Testament uses of this term and how it's used in different ways. So just put concept of ban or korban, if you goes by both terms, or harem, H-E-R-E-M, it's the Hebrew for it. And I want to give this to you under three specific places, okay? Number one, total destruction. Everybody, everything. Nothing that breathes comes out alive. Nothing material can be taken out. Total destruction of everything. Deuteronomy 20, 16 through 18. 1 Samuel 15, 3. And of course, Joshua chapter 7, Jericho and Achan's sin. Now the reason that the sin for the people to touch this is, it was just like that this city and all its people had been given to God as a sacrifice. And it's just like taking back a sacrifice from God. It was something that was deserved the debt, to take something back. The word harim means separated, so it's separated for God, you see. Now, number two is you kill all the persons, but you leave the property, the cattle and stuff. Now, that's what we have here in Deuteronomy chapter 3 and chapter 2. It's 2:34 and 35. 3, 6, and 7. They took the cows and stuff as booty. And so it's not total destruction, it's limited destruction. And then the third is kill only the men. Terrific. Deuteronomy 20, 10 through 15. Now I want to say two things to you about this, because we just don't understand it. It's different from our culture. This makes you have a perverted view of God if you say, well, God's so cruel, he killed all these people. Two things I want to say to you. Way back in Genesis, and I've forgotten the verse, I think it's Genesis 6 or Genesis 14, God tells Abraham, no, the sin of the Amorites are not yet full. Now, the Amorites are a collective term for all the tribes that lived in the Canaanite, the Canaan area, the Transjordan area. So God had been waiting on these people for years to turn to him, and they hadn't. So when God took the land from these people and gave it to Israel, it was nothing more than God's judgment on their lifestyle. So it's, number one, it's judgment in a sense. Number two, it's theological in a sense. Because many of these passages, if you'll read them, God says, kill everyone, for if you don't, they will corrupt you. Their evil practices and their religion will corrupt what you believe. And so by killing them all, you saved yourself from the corruption of their theological ideas and slant. So it's judgment and it's theological. It's both. Now, notice what it says in verse 4, 60 cities. Now, I've been reading the Talmud today, and I don't know what in the world, I don't know how they translate sometimes, but they say this 60 cities has to do with them sanctifying the land and all that. I really don't see at all how this 60 cities applies to anything but 60 cities. But the next little word is a very odd word, the region of the Argob or Arvab. The word region has two meanings in Hebrew. It can mean region, territory, land, or it can mean group, band, confederacy. And I think confederacy is a better word for it here. So it would be, as the confederacy in the Argob, which is a geographical region, the confederacy of cities, so these 60 cities also form the confederacy. And what we have here is two small political groupings inside the country of Bashan that they had to fight and defeat. Now, notice it in see verse 5 where it says, all the cities were fortified with high walls, gates, and bars. This whole area is a plateau. It's a plateau that up through the ground over the years, black basalt had formed. It's a volcanic thing. It's liquefied. It comes up through pores, and it just pours out over. And so all the ground is this black, hard kind of rock. Matter of fact, when it says that King Og had a bedstead of iron, he had a bedstead of basalt. It's black. It's as hard as iron. And these cities were not made with mud or bricks, but they were made with basalt blocks. And even the doors are stone slabs in stone hinges. Matter of fact, many of those cities are still uninhabited but still standing today. And the doors still freely move on the hinges. And the size of these buildings, some is huge. Some of the bedrooms are 10 by 14 by 11 feet tall. And it's something of the size of the Rephidim or the giants that live in this area. So probably these things were built by the previous inhabitants, are the race of giants. We call them by many names, the Tananim, the Zim, the Raphaelim, the Nephilim, and many names. But larger people, the buildings are huge. And some of these doors are 6 foot by 4 foot by 6 inches thick, a solid basalt. It'd take an army to lift that kind of thing. So these cities were very, very fortified. And you can imagine what a group of people who lived in the desert all their lives with just tents, when they saw these cities, it wowed them. It's like you walking in New York. You just, oh, golly. But their faith in God was stronger than their fear of these fortified cities. And they took them because God told them they could and they believed it. Now, down in verse 8 again, it says, and we took the land at that time from the hand of the two kings. Then over in verse 24, it says, and the hand of God, the strong hand of God. Now, what is the Hebraic phrase? What does it mean when it says the hand of God or the took it from the hand of the Amorites? What does that mean? It's speaking about delivering something from the power of. It's talking about taking something. It's talking about strength and might. Okay? So it's talking about the right hand of God. It's talking about strength and might. When it talks about taking something from the hand of someone, it's the Hebraic way of saying that they were defeated or destroyed and captured. Now, you see that last part of verse 8, this word Mount Hermon, I can't be sure. I looked everywhere I could find, and I just couldn't know. Hebrew does not have any vowels. It only has consonants. And the consonants of the word Hermon and the consonants of the word Harim are the same. And it may be a derivation from that. But there's other roots that it could be, so I can't be dogmatic. But it seems that Mount Hermon is the limit, the northern limit, of the land that God gave to the Israelite people. And therefore, it may be related to this total destruction idea in this Hebrew word. Now, you see there in verse 10, it calls it the tableland. Now, the tableland is going to be the tribal division for the tribe of Reuben. That's where he's going to get, okay? Now, notice, if you would, down in verse 11, when it says the Rephaim. Now, here again is a problem. If you take the Hebrew consonants of this word without vowels, because the vowels weren't put in until about the 9th century A.D. by Jewish scholars called the Masoretes. That's 900 years after Christ lived before they put vowels in these Hebrew words. Now, these consonants can mean the shades, the realm of the dead, the spirits, the ghosts, if you please. But it can also mean the giants. And because it uses it here, the remnants of the Rephaim, it looks like to me it's talking about an ethnic group, or it's talking about the size of these old boys, because it's going to talk about the bedstead. So I think you've got to look at the context to see if it's talking about departed spirits, like a dead person, or talking about this ethnical group of giants. I just don't know which. Now, here I think it's got to be giants. Some see the word bedstead as being sarcophagus or coffin. And what we have here is not his bedstead, but his coffin. I really don't think that fits real well. I think it's probably bedstead, although even the Jewish Talmud relates it to a coffin. I think it's a bedstead. And this was a pretty big old boy here. This bedstead was 14 feet tall, approximately, and 6 foot wide. What a sheet it took to put on that guy's bed. And it's, you see this little Ramah, the sons of Ammon? That's not in Israel. That they're saying, man, you should. They got this guy's bed over there in this place. Like it's like it's in a museum over here, you know, or something. They're showing this king's bed. It was a huge bed. Now, what does it mean by an ordinary cubit? I bought a set of commentaries by a guy I really like called Rashi. He's a Jewish commentator of years and years and years gone by. And he says this is talking about the cubit of Og, that it's Og's cubit, which would be the end of the elbow to the tip of the middle finger of the giant Og. Well, that means the bed would be huge. It'd be a lot bigger than 14. Seems to me, when you read this, it says that an ordinary cubit's talking about a regular man's arm. And a regular man's arm is about 18 inches from the tip of the elbow to the tip of the middle finger. And that's what a cubit is. So when you read about the Noah's Ark and so many cubits, it's about 18 inches, something like that. Now let's read 12, if we could, down through 17. Follow me in your translation. So he took possession of this land at that time from Aor, which is in the valley of Arnon, and half of the hill country of Gilead, and its cities, and we gave them to the Reubenites and the Gadites. And the rest of Gilead and all of Bashan and the kingdom of Og I gave to the half-tribe of Manasseh. And all the region of the Argob belonging to Bashan, it is called the land of the Rephaim. And Jar, the son of Manasseh, took the region of the Argob as far as the borders of the Gershites and the Mahakathites, and called it, that is, Bashan, after his own name, Havothagar. Oh, you choke on that. And it is there to this day. And to Maker I gave Gilead, and unto the Reubenites and the Gadites I gave Gilead, even as far as the valley of Arnon, and the middle of the valley as a border, and as far as the river Jabbok, and the border of the sons of Ammon, and the Arabah, along with the Jordan, as a border to Chinnieth, even as far as the Sea of Aqaba, the Salt Sea, at the foot of the slopes of Pishah on the east. Now, you ought to try to read that before breakfast. Now, I need to go back and relate from these names what they are. Well, that'll kill you. That's terrible. Why couldn't they have names like Smith and Jones? And, you know, of course, I guess the Jews think the same about us, don't they? Somebody named Ralph? Never mind. Now, the Reubenites and the Gadites are simply sticking an ite on the end of a tribe. So these are the tribes of Israel, Reuben and Gad, okay? Now, you see the half-tribe Manasseh? What does it mean, the half-tribe Manasseh? First, who is the other half-tribe? Ephraim, okay? And why are they half-tribes, Phil? Right. Joseph had one inheritance. And when Joseph brought his sons to his daddy, Jacob, Jacob blessed those two boys, and by blessing those two boys, passed them under his loins, under his thighs, and that's the official Jewish way of adoption, and those boys were adopted, but only as half-heirs. So each one had half of the land that Joseph should have inherited. Now, so notice there in verse 14 where it says, Jair, son of Manasseh. Now, this word son of does not mean son of. And you can find that in 1 Chronicles 2:22 where it says this man's the son of someone else. This means descended of. And the reason you can't go with Usher and say that the world was created in 4004 is because Usher forgot the fundamental principle of Hebrew psychology that says that when you say somebody is the son of, that doesn't mean the direct son of, but in the lineage of, and there is hundreds of genealogies that we don't have between Noah and all them and Adam and us. So many generations are left out, and they just hit the high points as they go back through. That's why you can't date like that. You can't take this guy's life and this guy's life and this guy's life and add it all up, because many are skipped. Now, this guy, this whole account, is mentioned in Numbers 32:41, parallel passage, Numbers 32:41. Now, I got confused when I went through here and trying to see exactly what was happening. And what confused me is these accounts are jumbled in the sense that 12 and 13 are general. They take the land, they describe the geographical locations, and it shows generally what happened. And then 14 through 16 go back and put details in the generalities of 12 and 13. And boy, it confused the hound out of me. Now, if you don't have a map when you go through this, you're not going to understand at all what's happening, because all these place names are on those maps. And you need to, when you see a place name, you need to look at your map till you find it. Because if you just read this and don't look at a map, it is just going to mean nothing to you. But if you look at a map, you can see exactly what they're talking about. You can see the King's Highway, and you can see the Jordan Valley called the Arabah and all that. Aqaba, and so it's important to have a map. Now, notice if you would where it mentions two little countries, the Gershites and the Mahakathites. Now, these are a different racial ethnical group, and they form the northern border of the land of Bashan. And Israel did not capture these people. They were not conquered. They were just the borderland, and God didn't give them these countries. Now, you can see that in Joshua 13:13. It's a good reference to those little countries. Now, you see this little Hebrew word? In my margin, it has the words, the towns of Fair. How many of you have New American Standard Bible? You see in the margin where it says, little 2, and it says, look in the margin, and it has it translated there, the towns of Fair. I have no idea under the sun where they got that from. Zero do I know where they got that from, because this word doesn't mean that at all. This Hebrew word means in the towns of, the region of, or the kingdom of Jair. And I don't know where that word fair came from at all. Unless this Hebrew name for Jair is another word for fair, and I couldn't find it. So it means the region of, the kingdom of, the towns of. So this man was a descendant of Manasseh. He took a little realm in this thing that they're captured. Now, verse 15 has a... Yeah. Do what? Do what? Mine has fair. When did you buy yours, Harmon? When did you buy your Bible? Great. What we have the first translation of the New American Standard. Mine's the first edition ever was out. And they didn't make these corrections till your edition. Okay, so that's something. They left those words out. Well, good to see those boys are fallible. Okay, so I'm glad they changed that in yours. Both of them. That's excellent. Good. They found their sins and repented. Well, anyway. Thank you, honey. In verse 15, we'll talk when we get home. In verse 15, put out of verse 15, CF Numbers 32, 39, and 40. This is a parallel account in Numbers 32, 39, and 40 of this man, Maker. Okay? Now, you see in verse 17 the little word, Arabah. Where have you heard that before? Arabah? Let's see. It's the name of a new hairspray. No. This is another word, and please remember this, circle it and put this beside. This is another word for the Jordan Valley that goes from way up above the Sea of Galilee, past the Dead Sea, clear down all the way to the Gulf of Aqaba, way down in the Sinai Peninsula. It is the geographical rift that the Jordan River runs in, that all these other rivers run into. So whenever you see it in the Bible, it's talking about the Jordan Valley, all the way up and down the coast, in the middle there, okay? So that's what the Arabah is. Now, you see this little name, Kinnereth. The Sea of Galilee is called by several names. One name for the Sea of Galilee is the Sea of Kinnereth, and that's a town that was right close to that sea. So it goes by the Sea of Gennesaret, the Sea of Galilee, and the Sea of Kinnereth. Now, Pishnah, you see in verse 17, is either a mountain that we can't find or a mountain range, and many people believe that Mount Nebo, if you have your map there, turn to your map and you'll see Mount Nebo marked with a red X. Now, many think that Pishnah and Nebo are synonymous. It's in the same area as Nebo anyway, so I don't know if it's synonymous or not, but it's a mountain there, okay? And notice in verse 18, and I'm going to read 18 through 22. Then I commanded you at this time, saying, the Lord your God has given to you this land to possess it, and all the valiant men you shall cross over armed before your brothers, the sons of Israel. But your wives and your little ones and your livestock, and I know you have a whole bunch, shall remain in the cities which I have given you, until the Lord gives you rest, gives rest to your fellow countrymen as to you. And you shall also possess the land which the Lord your God has given them beyond the Jordan. And you may return every man to his possession which I have given you. And I commanded Joshua at that time, saying, your eyes have seen all that the Lord your God has done to these two kings. So the Lord shall do to all the kingdoms into which you are about to cross. That last verse is a theology again. So God acted in the past. Joshua, look what he's done. You can trust him today. Now, notice in verse 18, little phrase, the Lord your God has given you this land. This is a theological statement. This says God is sovereign. God is behind the division of land. God is the one who is behind what happens to the nations of the world, what it's saying otherwise. And then notice in the second part of verse 18 where it says, and valiant men shall cross over armed before you. Because Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe Manasseh were on the eastern side of Jordan, and their land was already conquered now. All the tribes of Israel fought for these three tribes' land. And now, these three tribes can't sit home and say, I hope you have a good fight. We'll be praying for you, boys. No, God says, you guys go before the other sons of Israel until they win their land. Now, this little word, just a minute. See where it says, verse 19, and I know you have much livestock. Little parenthesis there. How'd they get that livestock? Where'd it come from? This brought from Egypt? This is the spoil, right? And then notice down here it says, God says, I gave them to you. Yes, which I have given to you. That's part of verse 19. What does it say to you theologically that God gave the cattle of Og and Sihon after they'd killed all the people to the children of Israel? Does that bother you? I want to say the source of all blessings is God. The New Testament says every good and perfect gift comes down from the Father of lights, in whom there is no variation or turning. Now, we do not understand always how we get the blessings that God sends. Sometimes we receive things and we just don't really understand how we got them or why we got them or the circumstance involved. But I want to tell you, I am theologically committed to the fact that God is in control of his world. And that Satan, this is not the devil's world, he's only a puppet to what God let him do. And so all things work together and we don't understand how or why. And it may seem unfair to us that God would take one man's cattle and kill that man and give his cattle to someone else and then say, I've given it to you as a blessing. But let me just say to you, we don't understand all that God's doing. And the day you think you can understand God, man, you're in bad shape. Because he's not God anymore if you can understand him. So some of these Old Testament things we're going to have problems with. And we're not going to understand why God did it and how God did it. But I'm just going to say this. I don't know why and how, but I know he had a purpose in it. Okay? I have to leave it with that. And verse 20, a little word's used. God's going to give them rest. Now, a real quick sideline, please. Many of you, if you've read the book of Hebrews, and by the way, the book of Hebrews is the best commentary on the Pentateuch, the Old Testament. So if you want a good commentary, read along, and you're too chinchy to buy it in the store from Winston, read Hebrews. I'm telling you, you can't understand Deuteronomy unless you buy a commentary. And I implore you to buy a commentary, some commentary on Deuteronomy. The best out is the Tyndale series in the Old Testament by Thompson, I think. Is Deuteronomy. You need to buy one. If you can't and won't, read Hebrews. Okay? Now, in the book of Hebrews, the word rest is used three ways, and it confuses everybody. Rest is speaking of the seventh day rest as God rested from creation. The Sabbath, we call it. The second thing of rest is talking about the promise. God said to those people who wouldn't go in, "You shall not enter my rest." Now, he wasn't talking about heaven or salvation because they didn't have the concept of heaven in the Old Testament. What God's saying, you can't enter the promised land. So that's a second. And the third rest used in Hebrews is heaven, the eternal rest. Now, what rest is this right here? One, two, or three? Is this the seventh day rest of creation? Is this the rest of the promised land, or is this the rest of heaven? It's got to be the promised land, right? He's saying, I'm going to get you into the promised land. They are going to enter my rest, and I give them rest, okay? Now, that doesn't say sitting down and relaxing. That's a theological concept for possessing the promised land. C.F. Hebrews. Now, in verse 21, your translation has, "And all that the Lord your God has done." One real problem with these commentators, the reason they said that there's two authors here, is Moses flip-flopped between the Lord your God and the Lord our God, and the Lord your God and the Lord our God, and it's confused even the guys who wrote these Bibles, because in the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Old Testament, done at least 4 B.C., it has the word our God. But the Masoretic text, the Hebrew Bible, has the word your God. So there's no big thing about this. We don't have a faulty Bible because of this. It's just Moses' flip-flopping way of saying your God, our God. And I just think it's variety. When you talk to somebody, you never say the same thing over and over again. It's tired. You know, you don't say the same words over. You try to find synonyms and variations to make it a little bit different so it won't be so boresome. We have a verbal account that's been written down. So I think Moses just used variety in his speech. Now, you notice where it says, the Lord your God is the one fighting for you? That's a great promise. That's a great promise. You didn't take this land by your own effort and strength. God's the one who gave this to you. And if I was prone to spiritualize and allegorize, I could preach an hour right there. But since I'm not, I won't. You can figure it out for yourself. Verse 23 through the end. And I also pleaded with the Lord at this time, saying, now verse 23 through the end is a very personal note for Moses. This is the only place in all the Bible that we have a recorded personal prayer of Moses. Every time Moses prays, he prays for the people, or he prays for the land, or he prays for... But this is a glimpse into Moses' heart. This is the only personal prayer of Moses. Matter of fact, in the Talmud, the Jews say, if you're going to pray for personal things, use this little phrase in verse 23. And if you're going to pray in an intercessory way, use the phrase that Moses used back when he prays for Israel in the golden calf experience. So two different ways. This is Moses' personal prayer. And it says, I pleaded with the Lord. Now, that's not a strong enough word. I earnestly implored the Lord. I desirously prayed. I pleaded. I begged. Any way you can say it in English, this is a strong Hebrew word. Moses is in agony over this. And he comes to the Lord now. I implored. I pleaded. I begged with the Lord. This time saying, and... O Lord God, now right here is two combinations of words I want to stop. I don't know, see the word Lord there? Does your translation have Lord in capital letters, L-O-R-D, everyone capitalized? Well, it shouldn't be. I've told you before that every time that L-O-R-D is, Peggy, does y'all's edition have it capitalized? Is the R, a capital R, is a little R? It's a little? You sure? Well, they changed it again, because mine has it all, it's smaller letters than the L, but it's capitalized letters. It's not like a regular printed R in the rest of the letters. Now, every time that capital L-O-R-D, that is supposed to be the Jewish way to write the covenant name for God, Y-H-W-H, Yahweh. Now, the problem here is the word Lord here is the word Adonai. That's the Hebrew word for Lord. But the word God here is the Hebrew word YHWH. So what he's saying is Lord Yahweh. He's saying Master Covenant God of Israel. That's what he's saying. Okay? And this is very seldom used. I think two or three times all this little phrase is ever used in the whole five books of Moses. This is Moses' prayer language, if you please. This is the way he addresses God when he talks to him privately. O Lord God, Thou hast begun to show thy servant thy greatness and thy strong hand. How so? The wilderness that we're talking about? No. What he's talking about is the capture of these two tribes on the Transjordan, the eastern side of the Jordan. Moses says, I'm getting so excited, God. The promise is about to be fulfilled. We're about to enter the rest of the promised land. Wouldn't you let me go in? And so he begins to talk to God. And notice what he says in verse 24. For what God is there in heaven or earth who can do such mighty works as this? Now here's my question. Please put the side of that CF, Exodus 15:11, which is the same kind of thing. Is this the concept that God is the supreme God among many? That's called henotheism. Does this mean that Moses is not denying the existence of other gods, but he's just saying that God is the strongest? Is that what this is saying? Or is this monotheism, one and only one God, no other gods, but is it kind of a way of not saying these other gods exist, but just a literary way of saying you're the strongest, you're the most powerful? Now, I really don't know. I tend to think that the older parts of the Old Testament are not monotheistic, one God, but henotheistic, our God's the strongest God. And yet, there are some prayers in Deuteronomy 6 called the Shema, which the Jews begin every worship service with. It says, Hear, O Israel, the Lord thy God is one Lord, and you shall worship him with all your heart, soul, mind, strength, body. And that implies monotheism. So I don't really know. I'm not sure if Moses believed in one universal, all-powerful God and nothing else. It may be. You see, remember in the quote, in the second chapter of Hebrews, where it says, And thou hast made man a little lower than what? Okay, and that word for angels is the word Elohim that's translated God in the Old Testament. So some translations today are putting, Thou hast made man a little lower than God or the gods. It could be that what we're talking about here is the spiritual forces, the other angels, the fallen angels. Paul would say that idols are nothing more than sacrificing to demons. So it may be that what Moses is saying is that there are other spiritual forces, but there's only one supreme God. Now that fits better in my theology than saying that he believed in other gods. But he did believe in other spiritual forces that were active. You see, Moses believed in angels, I think, because he'd seen them, right? So I think he made this thing about other gods. From my understanding, I understand it better to say not other gods like God is God, but other spiritual forces that have power over men. That's just me. Now, notice in verse 26, And the Lord was angry. Does God get mad? Does God get mad? Well, it bothers me that God would get mad. Let me tell you why it would bother me. God is a supreme being. He should not be moved by the emotional outburst of humans. But think with me for a minute. How else can you describe God, who is a personal being upset with something without using human terms that we relate to? There's no way that we could say God is Erica Bakaboo. You know, that would mean nothing to nobody, right? So we say God is angry because we understand that. But really, we got to realize that God is not a man. God does not think like men. God does not look like men. And so God does not have the personal characteristics of fallen men, one of which is anger, being mad and then getting over it. No, God's not like that. God is a supreme ruler and creator of all the world that has our complete life before him. And he is not controlled by up and down emotional cycles. But we have to talk about God as if he was to relate to him how we as men can understand him as a personal being. Does that make sense to you? The same way saying that God walked through the Garden of Eden, or God rode the clouds of heaven. God doesn't walk because God doesn't have a body, and God doesn't ride the clouds because he don't need to, because he's present everywhere. Now you see what I'm saying? We use human things to describe the nature of God, knowing that we can't describe God, so we have to. Well, I'll give you another one. Jesus sitting on the right hand of the throne. Do you think God sits on a throne? He's got to have a body if he sits on a throne. And he doesn't have a body. So talking about God's throne is a way of talking about God's power, control, sovereignty, majesty, might. But I don't think God has a throne. You see, again, we've got to realize this is called anthropomorphic. We speak about God as if he was a man, but we've got to remember that God is not a man. He is a spirit. He is a personal spirit, but he is a spirit and not a man. And he's not like men. He's God. Now, notice if you would, please, when it says, let's see. Listen to what God says to Moses. Enough! Speak to me no more about this matter. Moses had been praying over and over and over and over and over again. God, please let me go in. God, I'm sorry. Please let me go in. God, please let me go in. And God, finally God says, Moses, I've heard it enough. You ain't going in. Quit bugging me about it. That's what it means. Leave me alone about this, Moses. Don't pray anymore about this. No. Finally, once and for all, no. Now, notice the next little part about this, and it's very important. Look at verse 27. Go up the top of Mount Pisgah. Lift up your eyes to the west, the north, the south, the east. See it with your eyes, for you shall not cross over Jordan. Now, this to me is a perfect example of combining God's love and God's wrath. God said, Moses, I'm sick and tired of you praying about this. You can't go in. But Moses, if you want to, I'll let you see it. So he would not repent. He told Moses, speak to that rock, don't hit it. Moses struck it in open disobedience, and Moses paid the price for disobedience. So God's justice is upheld. Moses could not go in the promised land. But God said, Moses, I'll show it to you. And it may be something more than that. Because if you'll read Genesis chapter 13, verses 14 through 17, this is exactly what God did to Abraham when he overlooked the promised land. Took him up on a mountain and said, Abraham, look to the south, the north, the west. And by looking at it, God said, everything you see will belong to you. Now, Abraham didn't possess it personally. It was a promise to his descendants. And the same kind of thing seems to be with Moses. God said, look, Moses, as far as you can see, that's all going to belong to the people of God. But Moses, you can't go. So I think it's a combination between God's mercy and God's love. And I want to say something else to you. I think it's very important. Moses was a great man, possibly the greatest man in the Old Testament, next to someone like Abraham. Great man of faith, deepness of faith, spiritual, spoke to God face to face like no one else ever has, probably. But God is not a respecter of persons. And God told this man with the greatest faith in the Old Testament, no. Sometimes God will say no. And how much faith you have does not determine if you pull God's string, because God's not a puppet for you to manipulate. Sometimes God says no to the greatest faith in the world. Number two, sometimes God says no to his choicest saints. It's not who you are that makes your prayers valid. It's who you know, and that's Jesus Christ. God knows no favorites, you see. Even Moses wouldn't listen. Now, verse 28, but charge Joshua and encourage him and strengthen him, for he shall go across to the head of my people. Now, Moses could have said, I'm going to take my ball and go home if I can't go. I'm just going to quit. You do it yourself. But he didn't. And God told him and said, go back and let go of the reins, Moses. Time for you to die. Really, verse 3 through the last part of his death is really a very short period of time now. This Moses, you've had the reins now for almost years and years and years. I don't know how many, 44, 45, he's been in control, 46, I don't know. And God's saying, this man who's been in control, you're not indispensable, Moses. You were a good servant, you were a good man, but I want you to turn control of this thing over to Joshua. You're the chief. He's saying, let go, Moses. Time to let go. And Moses, like the great man of faith that he was, knew he was not indispensable, and he handed the control of power to his servant, Joshua. And he didn't say, dead gum God, didn't do what I wanted to do. He said, Joshua, you can do it. Be strong. God's good. God will do what he promised. Joshua, take heart. It's on your shoulders now, but God will be with you like he was with me. Listen to what he's saying. And then finally he said, and so he remained in the valley opposite Baal Peor. That's right across somewhere from Jericho, and exactly where, we don't know. Right?